Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek from Bloomberg Radio.
That are filled with a lot of people as I look around us. We're so delighted to be back here at the U.S. Open and delighted to have back with us Kirsten Corio. She is Chief Commercial Officer of USTA. And we were talking, you've actually been with the organization now for
7 years. This is actually my 8th U.S. Open. And yes, we do count the 2020 pandemic U.S. Open because it did occur. We did work, but we just weren't here.
Well, and I will say, last year felt like, all right, everybody was back in a big way. You guys are having some record numbers again this year.
We are. We thought after 2022, the most spectacular U.S. Open ever, Serena evolving away from tennis and the mania around, gosh, we got to see her one last time. How do we top that in 2023? And then here we are. You mentioned it, Tim. No big three, no Serena. You know, we've wondered, us that are in the business, those of us that are fans, what will happen when they're no longer with us. And the truth is, we've been just astonished at the demand we've experienced.
Well, so why do you think that is?
You know, I think the new stars began to break through a bit more last year. The electric Carlos Alcaraz, Coco Gauff, there's so many others. And I think people have just rediscovered tennis is amazing. There are new stars all the time. And also, the U.S. Open is just a fantastic experience. And there's so much more to do than just watch tennis. The tennis, of course, is the anchor, but it's also just a great event for food and beverage, for experience, for being out in a beautiful day.
Carol mentioned record crowds here earlier this week. Yesterday, top 73,000 people for the first time. What's capacity here? How much bigger could you get if you wanted to get bigger?
I honestly think this is it. We're kind of at the cap, right? We want everyone to ensure that they have a great experience, that they can get around and get to the different courts, and I'm not sure we can expand more than that.
I kind of agree with you just based on I was here Tuesday night and it was super crowded that night too. And you get to the point where, you know, you want to get in court 17 and you can't actually get in court 17 because it's full. But there are so many other places to go. So I guess I do wonder is like how you balance the experience of making sure that people get their money's worth without maximizing, you know, without putting at risk. Being comfortable here.
Yeah, and so I think that's it. I think we'd love to be able to welcome everyone that wanted to come, but at the same time, we've got to protect the experience, and that's where the Fan Week experience becomes really important, too.
Mm. How do you, you know, I was curious, actually thinking about early metrics, and did you guys quickly get an idea of what the event was going to be? Like, what was early demand like?
The earliest one we saw was when we went out with the full series subscriber renewal. That's kind of your season ticket holder, right,
yeah,
if you're a team. And we renewed it better than 95%. And at that moment, that was in late January, we said, wow.
So literally almost right after.
Yeah. And at that point in time, you know, you don't know who's playing. You know that certain players have retired and will not be back. But that was really just the first indicator of, wow, this is going to be big again.
Kirsten, talk to us, too, about the people who come and remind us of how diverse it is and people coming from all over the world.
Yeah, and the international travel, you know, we've seen it in New York, seems to be really back. In a typical pre-pandemic year, we'd be anywhere from 20 to 25% international attendees at the U.S. Open, and we're back to that number. We're back to around 20%, maybe more. but it's just so, so great to see.
So that's something that you actually can't even describe. You kind of have to be there to feel it. Like you're mm-hmm. You're on one of these courts, and you're seeing two players play from not the U.S. They don't speak English as their first languages. And what you have is fans who are from those countries or perhaps even from New York City, mm-hmm. and they're cheering them on and in their native languages. And it's yeah. like, I'm like, this is New York. This is New York at its finest.
It is. Yeah, you really feel it. And I'm glad you experienced that on the outside
courts.
It
was pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right, so talk to us about sponsors, right? You have to think about who you're sponsoring, and I feel like you have people that have, or companies and entities that have been with you from year to year, but how you continue to evolve that or grow that.
So we have 24 sponsors. We have few long-term, very loyal, very deep partnerships with these sponsors. Over half of them have been with us, actually seven have been with us for more than 30 years. Very long-term partnerships. It's really been extraordinary for us to experience. And these partners are long-term. We renew it long-term. And we want to ensure that they can meet their objectives here, that they can activate their brands in ways that are fantastic. And I really hope that you can experience it when you get out there watching tennis. Stop in some of the sponsor booths as well.
I bought a shirt like a Ralph Lauren. Like I do yeah. think about, it's not just about somebody slapping a logo.
No, it's a really deep activation. They're really out here interacting with the fans and enhancing the experience for the fans in really diverse ways.
What did you hear from your sponsorship staff this year in terms of the ease of getting these renewals, of going and getting new sponsors? There are some new partners here this year. We like to talk to people like you because you have a good read on the entire economy. You mm-hmm. you get those updates each quarter from your staff. But what did they tell you throughout the year as they were trying to secure these partnerships?
So in all of our partnerships, I'll say, the intent to renew is incredibly strong. It's just a question of, what are your objectives and how do you see them evolving over the next term and how can we help you meet those objectives? So that hasn't really been a question. For new partners, we've seen more demand than we can satisfy. We do reach a point where we sell out of partnership positions and we've reached that. And so we've got more inbound demand than we can satisfy on the partnership front. And that's really an indicator of how valuable the audience is to them.
Do you ever, though, you said 24, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there ever... Okay, let's make it 26. Or is there, do you think about, let's not make it where we're slapping things, not, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, it's very not, deliberate.
Yeah. And so you do have like kind of a top point that you just say that's enough.
We do. We want to protect the exposure for the few partners that we have at the level that they have and ensure that they get the exposure that they've come to expect.
One thing I wanted to ask you, because we're going to talk a lot. We have a book about Althea Gibson. We're going to talk a lot more yeah. about equality and diversity. I'm thinking about Billie Jean King at the beginning of the yeah. week, former First Lady Michelle Obama. How, in terms of what you do, the importance of diversity and inclusion and thinking about that in our world, and then when you think about sponsors?
Wow, it's all incredibly important. So, okay, so you know we're celebrating 50 years of equal prize money. 50 years. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're still seeing that fight for equal pay on many different stages and arenas, and especially in women's sports. So we're incredibly proud of that. But we also like to, and our sponsors love this, that men and women they play on the same stage. They play on the same stage, the best men in the world, the best women in the world. They're watched by men and women equally. They're watched in person. You know, women buy tickets, men buy tickets. They both watch together. Mm-hmm. We're one of the most gender-neutral audiences that you can find in any sporting event. And so we're really proud of that. And our partners love that too. Of course they love reaching a very gender neutral and very female heavy, when you think about sports, audience that we offer.
So Kirsten, how do you take the momentum from this event, again, a record setting event, and use that to parlay interest into the next 4 or 5 year olds, the people who are going to be the next Francis Tiafos, the people who are going to be the next Coco Gauffs?
So that's why we play, right? That's why we're here. This event is here to inspire people to play tennis in the United States.
How do you make sure they get to experience it, though, that everybody gets to experience it?
So the qualifying tournament, which is played the week before the main draw, has been repurposed into Fan Week. Okay, so the qualifying tournament is the anchor of that Fan Week. We are free and open to the public that entire week. And all of the main draw players are here practicing on courts that are free and open to the public to come and sit up close and personal and watch them. And so we had a record audience that week. Over 155,000 people came through the gates that week and really were able to experience some of the top pros in the world up close and personal, but also watch some incredibly competitive tennis in the qualifying side, and all fan activations with our partners and opportunities for kids to get on courts and really hold a racket. Wilson distributed tens of thousands of free
wow.
rackets.
That's great.
Free rackets to those that had registered for the free fan access pass. And so we're literally getting rackets into kids' hands during that first fan week, and it's just so gratifying for us to see them then take those into their communities and play.
Just have about 25 seconds left here. What have you seen in terms of the interest among a younger population in general, either coming to it and also just playing in tennis?
Well, I think you may have some time with our CEO, Lucier, and we love to talk about the growth over the past 3 years that we've enjoyed in tennis. We've got over 23 million active players in the United States, over 30% increase over the past 3 years, and much of that coming from diverse populations where we want tennis to look like America and feel like America, and that includes the youth population, of course, as well.
You're so fun.
I love being here with you guys. Thanks for having me.
We love talking to you.
We just wish we could do this more than 2 days a year.
Can we come work for you?
Maybe we'll do Cincinnati next year, so why not?
Absolutely.
Kirsten, thank you. Be well.
Thank you for having me.
Kirsten Curio, USTA Chief Commercial Officer right here at the U.S. Open. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Kel Master, along with Tim Stenovic, live at the U.S. Open at the Arthur Ashe Stadium. We're literally right out. We're just in the midst of everything.
I can hear, you can hear the officials.
Yes.
You can hear the crowd cheering.
Yes.
You can sometimes hear a passionate player maybe grunt or scream. That's all part of the fun here at the U.S. Open.
It's so much fun. It's so alive. It's just a blast to be here. Having said that, we're sorry to our Bloomberg News team in particular, who we know are fans of
Carol,
tennis.
That is so cruel. Okay, next year you guys are coming here with us, okay?
All right, we've got two great stories. One is about former U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama. She spoke at Arthur Ashe earlier in the week advocating for equal pay for female athletes, and she's really the latest prominent figure to push for progress in women's sports. We talked about it a little bit with Kirsten about the importance of equality and diversity. And then writing about how the U.S. Open is a test for Carlos Alcaraz.
Yeah, is he the next great tennis player now that the Big Three is no longer the Big Three? We got Ira Boudouet joining us. He is Bloomberg News Global Business Reporter on Zoom in New York City. Also with us, Bloomberg News Senior Reporter Gillian Tan, back right now in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio.
I feel like, Gillian, we need to start with you because I feel like equality when it comes to sports remains an issue. And I know the USTA is working on it. But tell us about Michelle Obama, the former First Lady, earlier in the week, because she had some pretty strong words.
Yeah, so she kicked off sort of Monday night action after Coco Gauff won on Monday night. She came out to honor Billie Jean King, who, where exactly you are, you guys are in the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center. And so Billie Jean King, 50 years ago, went out, found sponsors, and it was actually Bristol Myers Squibb that came up with equal prize money for women's tennis. The year earlier, in 1972, she cashed a $10,000 check. Her male counterpart, Ilie Nastase, $25,000. So it was Billie Jean King 50 years ago pioneered, you know, equal pay in sport. It took the other Grand Slams, you know, decades to catch up. The Australian Open only did it in 2001, the French Open in 06, and Wimbledon was the last in 2007 with Venus Williams sort of helping get that along. But what's crazy is it's 2023 and some of the like lead-up tournaments to the US Open in Cincinnati, in DC, they're still, you know, women are earning a fraction of what the men are earning.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned Cincinnati. I mean, it was remarkable to see that the women's prize pot is less than half of what men
get.
But it's not just tennis, Julian. This is like, I mean, think about the struggle of the U.S. national women's soccer team and female soccer players that we've experienced here in the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. So the World Cup recently has thrown a huge spotlight on it. Like our colleagues wrote about how in Spain, you know, there's a lot of debate, especially because Spain won. But it's not just in soccer. It's in basketball. It's in pretty much every sport across the globe. You know, tennis is one rare sport where prize money is equal, but it only in certain events like the one that's happening this fortnight at Flushing.
Ira, we want to bring you into the conversation. You've got a great story about Carlos Alcaraz. But before we get to it, you know, you cover sports, you love sports. What do you think about, you know, when it comes to still kind of this fight for equality between women and men when it comes to sports?
You know, I think tennis is a really good, I mean, I don't think it's an accident that Billie Jean King has been a pioneer in this and that tennis is really part of what has led the way for equal pay because it is an individual sport primarily. And the women have been a huge draw. You look at Serena Williams, one of the biggest athletes of her generation, male or female. And so I think they have some of that leverage, and Billie Jean King really showed them how to use it. But the job is still not done. What it is surprising to see at this stage in the game that we still have competitions on the tour that are not with equal prize money.
So the tour...
Yeah, it's really surprising to... Oh, go ahead, Jillian.
Sorry, just to jump in, like the tour actually has been feeling the heat from the whole world sort of saying, hey, what's going on, guys? And they've actually outlined a plan to have equal prize money, but not till 2027 at some of these big events.
Why so long? Why is everything so long? All you have to do is like say,
give me the money.
Do it. Just do
so
it.
I think
why
it's about sponsorship, Carol. So it's about, you know, the sponsors, you know, they don't believe the eyeballs, the viewership is there. But if your numbers are to be believed, like the US, the soccer down in Australia, like the ratings were off the charts.
Well, we just talked with Kirsten, you know, Curio. She is here. She's chief commercial officer. She's doing the sponsorships. We just talked to her about this issue. And even though you don't have, you know, Serena here, you know, that things are changing. The older, you know, elite, if you will, from tennis is moving on slowly. That still, you're getting record numbers here. So it's just interesting about this idea that the eyeballs, I don't know. I feel like it's an old argument. Having said that, we do want to get to Ira, your story. Talk to us about Carlos Alcaraz. He's part of the next generation, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And this has been the question on the men's side for decades now. What happens when Federer, Nadal, and Djokovic are done? And now that Federer's retired, Nadal's about to retire, Djokovic looks like he has some, you know, left in the tank, but is obviously in his twilight years or entering them. Who's next? And I think Wimbledon and last year's Open, we kind of got a glimpse anyway at the answer, and it's Carlos Alcaraz. And what I was writing about is the opportunity that presents him, because if he can sort of consolidate that and dominate on the men's side for the next decade or two, because he is only 20, he could very realistically be the next sort of billion-dollar athlete. You know, you look at Roger Federer's lifetime earnings on the court, prize money, but also off it, where you get the majority. Tennis players, as in an individual sport, they can really cash in. And so Alcaraz stands to really profit from his brilliant play recently.
It's interesting, Ira. Tennis players can really cash in if they're the top of the top, right? Five of the 50 highest earning athletes of all time, this is in your story, according to estimates by Sportico, are tennis players. The thing is you have to be the top of the top to actually make a living, because, you know, there are so many players out there, many of whom qualified for the US Open this year, that really, you know, essentially live tournament to tournament and paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, I mean, it is a ruthless eat what you kill sport, and the pyramid, you know, the difference between 1 and 10 is huge, and the difference between 10 and 100 in the rankings is even wider. It's just very difficult. But if you can get to the top of the mountain, the rewards are as rich as in any sport. And for Alcaraz, it's interesting because in talking to marketing people, I talked to this guy, Bob Dorfman, who does sports marketing at Pinnacle Advertising. He's saying, you know, the ceiling is the limit for him in terms of categories, endorsement deals. Besides the obvious stay healthy, keep winning, he needs to sort of start to show his personality. Obviously, US is the biggest market. Everyone's always waiting for the next US tennis star, but Alcaraz can really capture that too if he works on his English a little bit more and just kind of lets the world see who he is. I was at this event at Lotte Palace Hotel before the Open, where they had him and a few other players, and he really was the star of the show. It's a little cocktail hour, and he has a big, contagious smile. He clearly knew how to work a room, but I think we've yet to see that kind of leveraged in a big way in endorsement deals and in marketing.
You know, Jillian, as we look at the, you know, next round for men's players in tennis, the next generation, I think about the next generation for women, and we're starting to see that. We certainly saw it last time around. But I do think about last time that I was here at the Open, I watched Serena and Venus play in a doubles match, and I watched Serena play what...
You saw her last match.
I saw her last match. You know, when I do think about the next generation for women, how are you thinking about it? And we really, I think, all did think Serena and Venus would make it so that there was more parity, and they definitely have moved it along, but we still have a ways to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a bunch of upcoming stars. Obviously, Coco's leading the way. Jessica Pegula, mm-hmm. her dad owns the Buffalo Bills. She's the third seed. Her and Coco actually play doubles together. Like, there's another American called Alicia Parks. Like, the bench is deep, and to Ara's point about, you know, upcoming U.S. players, there's a couple that are really already stamping their foot on the map. Francis Tiafoe, and then Chris Eubanks being one that have had deep runs in slams.
All right. Well, great stuff.
Looking forward to seeing a handful of those players today and tomorrow, Carol.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot, right, to look out for. Wish you guys both were here, but really fun to read both of your stories. So thank you so much for joining us today. Jillian Tan, of course, senior reporter at Bloomberg News, back there in our Interactive Brokers studio at Bloomberg headquarters in Ira Boudway, global business reporter on Zoom from New York City. That story, a Business Week story. So check it out, too, at Bloomberg.com/businessweek.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at QuickBooks.com/5APY.
Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
On grass or clay, and every day.
They're both okay.
But time is running short. Shall we say the ball is in your court?
Love it.
On grass or clay, they're playing it. It's not grass here, though.
Nope. Not these days.
Nope.
Not these days.
One of the things, I don't know when it comes to, I don't know if grass could be better with AI. Do you think it could be better with AI?
Well, Wimbledon.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about AI, artificial intelligence. It permeates everything that we do, including what's going on here at the U.S. Open.
Yeah, the U.S. Open is actually harnessing AI through their partnership with IBM. So we've talked a lot about in the past, Carol, about player analysis and predictions that are powered by IBM. But here's something cool that the tournament is doing this year. AI-generated commentary for match highlights. So the USGA can quickly get the highlights out to fans around the world. You know, you have hundreds of thousands of people come to this event every year.
Yeah.
But you have millions of people who actually follow the event at the USGA website and also through the app. And they need to get quick updates. And I guess my question is, you know, are we going to be out of a job because they don't even need announcers anymore?
Noah's laughing. We're not laughing. Noah Sykin is with us. He's VP of Sports and Entertainment Partnerships at IBM. Once again, back with us on site at the U.S. Open. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you guys?
Doing well. So tell us about this.
So AI commentary, there's a lot of tennis going on out here. There's 17 courts of action, but there's only commentators on two or three courts. We know Patrick McEnroe, John McEnroe, Chris Evert. Well, a lot of video is captured from those courts, and the USGA really asked us, you know, how do we create a better experience for people who are seeing these highlight packages? How do we lay commentary on top of those packages? And so that was a great challenge. So when you go to the usopen.org this week or download the app and you see these highlight packages for every singles match, what you'll see is AI-generated commentary laid on top of them.
When you say commentary, do you mean just text on screen or do you mean actual voice?
Yeah, voice commentary. So we'll provide a little texture about who those players are, maybe something about how they've played before, what countries they're from.
Does it sound like a human being or does it sound like a robot?
Well, I don't know what a robot sounds like anymore, but you know your...
I am a robot.
That's what a robot sounds
like. Definitely not. Look, we all have our GPS or our little smart devices and we have those voices and it sounds pretty much like that. But what we're excited about, in addition to what we're doing today, we're doing English language. But if you think about the players that come out here, they're from countries around the world. They have fans around the world. So next year, we'll be doing multi-language translation. So wherever you are in the world, you're going to get highlights in your language, which isn't available today.
How does it work? Like, what's the pool of information that it's using to do that, to make sure it's good? I'm sure you have people who are fact-checking and reviewing it. But how does it all work?
Yeah, so there's data feeds that come off the court, right? Yeah. And that captures all the statistical data from the court, from each competition. Then we use a large language model, which is the underpinning of our WatsonX generative AI platform. That large language model knows language already. It's already been taught language. So what we teach it is tennis. What a passing shot is, what a winner is, what Arthur Ashe Stadium is versus Louis Armstrong Stadium. So it knows language. We bring in the data feed. We teach it what a winner is and all those different dimensions. And then we bring them together to generate the commentary. So it's the data coming off the court combined with large language model combined with teaching tennis to the AI.
I'm not being facetious with this question at all.
Tim is still worried. No.
But I'm wondering about personality. You mentioned, you know, the McEnroe brothers, Chris Evert, like, this is, we those people are great at what they do because they're great at what they do. I mean, their personalities come across. We know them by now. If you've been watching tennis, you know them. If you just watched the U.S. Open, for 2 weeks, you get to know them. How do you give these bots personalities?
I don't know if personality is the right way to think about it, but, you know, reflecting on some of the commentators, if you were out here at 8, 9, 10 o'clock this morning, you'd probably see those commentators roaming around the practice courts. They know the players. They know the coaches, right? So there's texture that the commentators have. They probably have seen these players grow up, frankly. There's texture that the commentators have that the AI probably doesn't have. What we give is a little bit of an inflection. So the AI knows what a break point is. So the commentary around a break point is going to have a little bit more substance, a little bit more flair, so to speak, than a different point. Or the end of the mat or end of the set. All of those different dimensions around tennis are what drives a little bit more inflection and texture in the voice.
How does generative AI change Watson?
Well, I don't know if generative AI changes Watson, but the WatsonX platform is going to change how AI is able to be created.
Meaning what?
Speed. Speed and the availability of large language models. So, like I said, we use one of these large language models that was already taught speech and language. So it's already there, pre-baked.
Right.
Now, tune it to your task. Your task may be tennis. Your task may be creating a chatbot for a big bank to serve your customers better. Those underpinning development platforms have pre-baked models that allow for more rapid development, more varied use cases.
I keep thinking of the Jeopardy example, and I bring this up because you were very involved in all of this. And I'm just thinking, like, what did it take to make that work as well as it did? And now, how many years later, we're like, oh my God, generative AI. And I'm just curious how you guys are thinking about it and what it means, like, the next level.
Well, look, yeah, I'm glad the world finally caught up to us. and the Jeopardy project.
I handed that to you. You're welcome.
I'm glad that the world
but I'm curious.
Caught up to that. But, you know, it's really a whole different animal now
from
where we were, you know, years ago. And people are concerned about, you know, the challenging parts of AI. But the reality is, just like at the U.S. Open, AI is going to be assisting people. We're not replacing the commentators. We're adding new flavor. We're adding you know, value into the white space, the courts that weren't covered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how businesses are going to be thinking about it as well. You know, how do I create new experiences that add value?
What's been the uptick in that, in terms of that you've done that, the coverage, right? You started it here.
Yeah. Oh, we started this actually at the Masters.
Okay.
We progressed at Wimbledon. We bring it at the U.S. Open.
What kind
Open.
Of demand are you seeing it among?
So at Wimbledon, we saw over 2.5 million views of these videos, right? And we started with the commentary defaulted off. And immediately we saw people turning them on and wanting to hear this commentary, and so it went to default on. And we try to take a little slow start to anything, make sure that the users are having a positive experience, and we saw that at Wimbledon.
Hey, Noah, the USTA and the US Open, you've had this more than 30-year relationship with IBM, with them. How do you draw a line from the money you spend here to top-line growth at the company?
Yeah, well, one of my most exciting moments is when we're with a client or a customer and we share what we're doing, but, you know, how we created this engagement with fans or use large language models. And when the clients turn to us and say, we need that, we need to bring that into our business. That's a direct line between what we do here and a client saying, we need to work with you more deeply.
So what I'm hearing is upselling, not necessarily new customers.
I think it's probably a little bit of both. You know, if you're experiencing this on a mobile application or a website, we get inbound demand. Like, I want to know more about that. Mm. Set up an appointment with one of our, you know, experts. So it's a little bit of both, but certainly there's a big expansion that we see with existing clients.
When you think about kind of where it goes next, right? 30 years you guys have been working and developing different things to kind of have fun when the customer experience, your clients, the IBM customers. So how do you think about kind of where it goes? Like, what's next? What's after you're done, your boss is like,
yeah,
hey.
I'm not a huge prognosticator, but I really just think about how productivity is going to be accelerated with these capabilities. Think about coding. Coding is going to be one of the first places, you know, AI-generated code is going to, again, we talked about speed earlier.
Yeah.
If AI can help coders generate code to create new experiences more quickly, then businesses are going to be able to please their customers.
If Microsoft hadn't made that investment and announcement, would we be talking as much about AI, in your view? Would something else have done it, or would it? I'm just curious. Like, all of a sudden, it's not like it's new.
No, I don't know if it's a matter of the investment or not. I think it's a matter of when people touch these things, it just creates an extra level of interest. And I think some of the things we've seen with ChatGPT, where now people can literally get their hands on it.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a college student trying to write a college essay, now they're having a very visceral experience with, you know, how language can be used. But the reality is that trust is going to be really important in this era.
Agreed.
And using trusted data, and that's what we really pride ourselves
on. We have a colleague, Matt Miller, man. He's on ChatGPT
all the
time.
He's doing on that thing all the time. I don't know what he's doing.
Asking it everything.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having
me.
We
always appreciate it. Noah Sykin, VP of Sports and Entertainment Partnerships. He's a busy guy here at IBM.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus, global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Carol Messer along with Tim Stenebeck live at the U.S. Open. We're just outside Arthur Ashe Stadium, having really a lot of fun. And when she's not here at the Open, although she is right now, she comes
every year
all the time with her family. She's usually pretty busy reporting on some really important stuff.
Yeah, she's got an educational angle, an economic one, and in the end, it's all about the big money in the form of college endowments or the big moves that are happening when it comes to some of these colleges and universities.
A few moves today. Bloomberg News higher education finance reporter Janet Lauren here with us on site at the U.S. Open. Hello, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me again.
We love having you here. We love seeing your family. They're on the sidelines. Some news today. Yale's president. What's going on?
Yeah, Peter Salve announced that he is retiring after 11 years of leading Yale in New Haven, Connecticut, and he's going to go back to being a professor. You probably don't know this, but he was one of the people who developed the idea of emotional intelligence. Mm.
I did not know that. So why is he like done?
Well, it's been a tough decade plus one in higher education. We had COVID. There's a lot of fundraising, and it's been a tough time. Finances are not so easy this year. We're going to talk about endowment returns. Last year was not a great year for endowments, although Yale of the Ivy League schools was the only one that was had a positive return.
So what is a typical tenure for a college professor? I mean, a university president, who oftentimes are started as college professors.
Yes, of course. They're always college professors. It used to be about 10 years, but lately we've been seeing a lot of retirements. Keep in mind, one of the biggest jobs is not teaching, which is the fun part for them, but it's raising money.
It's like, come on, that's all they do is raise money.
But right now, dealing with some big issues, affirmative action. Yale was not a litigant, but it's one of its rivals, Harvard, was. And that's what a lot of them are trying to figure out, how they're going to go about the next academic cycle where they're recruiting kids. You don't talk about race, but Harvard, you know, their essay, they've changed their essay, and it's not going to be an easy time. Although, of course, they've been expecting this for the last year.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. I was talking actually with Tom Keene, and he's got a daughter who's getting ready or starting to think about college and so on and so forth. But what's interesting is
Chief Investment Officer.
I don't know who we're hearing.
Are we hearing somebody? You have to figure out, right?
Yeah.
We're hearing some Bill Stone earlier. All right, they're going to get that fixed once we.
They're going to fix that.
We're going to keep talking to Janet.
We are.
Ignore the background.
But
noise.
He was talking about that. All of a sudden, they're thinking about training for kids for SATs and PSATs again. I'm like, I thought they were done with that. And he's like, no. Apparently, colleges are finding that's a good metric to figure out if kids can do well at their schools.
Yes. Well, MIT last year said we are bringing it back, and MIT is one of a few outliers. Many of the schools are still saying we're going to give it another couple of years. We want to evaluate how kids are doing in their freshman year. But MIT is a place where you got to do the math and science in order to be successful. Purdue also announced that they are going back. And another school, Georgia Tech, only had the pause for 1 year of the requirement.
Is that going to be the trend, do you think? We'll start to see colleges bring it back?
It's unclear, especially with the affirmative action ruling. There's a question of access, and everybody knows that wealthier kids tend to do better because they have more resources for test prep. They perhaps have more time. And so we'll see. It's been very interesting. You know, Harvard announced about a year and a half ago that they were going to have a 4-year moratorium before anybody else did. Mm. And you kind of think, well, what do they know that everybody else doesn't know? And, well, they were they were preparing for what was the inevitable affirmative action ruling a couple months ago.
It's getting harder and harder, right, to run a university system. Go back to you were talking about endowments. So what are we seeing this year? Because they've had a tough year,
yeah,
right?
So this year we're hearing, you know, 8.7%, which doesn't sound like a bad year, but then you throw in inflation and there's not really a lot left. And considering last year was on average was a minus 10% return, not such great times. So people say, but what are you talking about? Harvard has $50 billion. Yeah. How is that not enough money? Which is an excellent point. But they're used to spending a lot. It's constrained. You know, if you get a gift for, you know, the Yale hockey team, you can't spend it on a science building. So it'll be interesting to see. You know, we know that most of these big endowments are in alternatives, in private equity, in hedge funds, and, you know, there's an influx, huge amounts of money chasing the same deals, and the returns aren't as great. And the smaller endowments this year actually did better. Look at the stock market. It was up 18% in that same period.
So when you have a college endowment that doesn't do as well as the benchmarks, how does it play out when it comes to admissions? How does it play out when it comes to investments that the college or university makes in terms of expanding the campus and access as well?
So, good question. They are going to say the same thing year after year. We don't look at the 1-year return. We're really more concerned at the 10-year return, but that's also constrained. If you look at some of the larger schools, like Princeton, for example, is a really good example. They've had stellar returns year after year, and they decided several years ago that they're going to show that they're spending their money, and they enlarged their class size. So I believe we're in the second year where they're enlarging each freshman class is bigger by several hundred students. They're building a brand new campus. If you walk in that school around that campus, there's tons of construction. So they're saying to Congress, hey, we recognize we've got a lot of money, but look, we're spending it. Because don't forget, they were taxed, in the Trump tax era 2017, endowments had the worst fear was being taxed. And they're still working on trying to repeal that.
Speaking of a tax, we do wonder kind of the impact. I don't know if this is apples to apples, but what's going to happen as we start to see students having to pay back their student loans, right? There's been a moratorium post-pandemic and during the pandemic, obviously, but that's going to change. And we talk about it a lot in terms of the economic impact. You've been writing about this as well.
Yes. So come September 1st, interest starts accruing, and come in October 1st, former students will start to see their bills come. And it's a big change after 3.5 years. There has been no interest accruing, no debt collection, and you keep this in mind. If the U.S. government was a bank, it would be the fifth largest bank in America.
That's the stat that stuck out for us, I think.
So it's a lot of craziness within the education department trying to work with their loan servicers and try to let students know how much they're paying. And there's so many different repayment plans, and it's kind of confusing.
What's happened to the servicers over the last 3 years?
So a bunch of them have left. Mm. And Navient, the big one, is gone, formerly Sallie Mae, and they've been consolidated among smaller. So it's kind of confusing when I believe it's at least 3/4 of students are getting a new loan servicer. You know, the bottom line is you got to be in touch with your servicer and not wait and be proactive.
I feel like when we talk student loans, when we talk endowments, it's all just like tons of money.
They'll find you, you know. That's what I know about these student loan servicers. They'll find you.
That's so true. Or they'll garnish your wages.
Back to that.
It happens. All right. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest
of
the
opening.
Janet Lauren, of course, of Bloomberg News, higher education finance reporter, joining us here at the U.S. Open. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic, and this is Bloomberg.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep trying, stay in prison.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 18 minutes left to go until we wrap up the Thursday trade. A nice breeze blowing through us here at the U.S. Open. And delighted to have with us to talk about the trade, Bill Stone, Chief Investment Officer at Glenview Trust Company. Nice to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to be there. Should we talk tennis or should we talk
markets?
Let's
talk tennis.
What can you actually predict? Who's going to win or where the markets are going to go?
I can do neither. I was always a Federer guy, so, you know, now I have to find a new, you know.
Who's it going to be?
I don't know.
I got some ideas.
he does.
I think I'm going to pull for the old guys and go, you know, Djokovic for now while he's okay. Here. But, you know, it's really nice to watch Alcaraz. It's nice to see some new faces. I mean,
Andy
awesome.
Murray's still here.
I just watched him for a little while there. Yeah, that was good. Isner, unfortunately, knocked out, but yeah. Enjoyed seeing him in his last hurrah. So, you know.
Tiafo?
Yeah, he's good to watch. I love tennis, so I can watch pretty much anything if it's, you know, good tennis.
You and me both.
Jay Powell?
Hey, you know.
He goes to dead concerts. I'm not sure if he plays tennis. I don't know that, you know, we kind of make a joke out of it. I know it's important in terms of what the Fed does, but on any given day, the thinking around monetary policy or where rates go can change in a heartbeat. So, for investors, what do you think is really constructive to focus on?
So I just try and figure out or think about how sticky this inflation is going to be. You know, I mean, you can cut it a million different ways. Actually, maybe you asked me a question, what's constructive? I'm not sure that's constructive, but that's what I spend time thinking about because I just try and figure out, well, you know, the market's pricing in no more hikes. To me, it seems hard. I actually think we have at least one more hike and maybe more in
why,
us.
Why do you think that?
Because I just think, well, and it all goes, we keep preluding the jobs report tomorrow, but I just think that it's hard for wages to come down enough to then help out on kind of core inflation.
What's sticky?
Yeah, that's the last piece, really, you know, because he talked about it in his speech, Powell, that is, at Jackson Hole, where, you know, you're seeing some help a lot of other places, but wages yet still aren't there, and you know, maybe housing is picking back up again. I thought about it this morning, and it seems as challenging as ever to figure out where we're at, because you're at a point where then you also have to keep in mind, I mean, lately we've gotten economic data that's just accelerating, right? I mean, you probably have to pencil in 3.5% real growth here for the third quarter. Not that I don't think it's going to come off from there, but still.
You don't buy it what the Atlanta Fed is predicting? It's not, a little bit more aggressive. Just
yeah, not
a little
quite
bit.
That high, but because I think it'll come off. But still, 3.5, I mean, how do you think inflation should slow down a lot when you're growing that fast?
I was thinking about the conversation we had yesterday with Andy Brown and this whole concept that who'd have thunk that the U.S. economy would be growing faster than the Chinese economy?
That's pretty remarkable.
Right?
Yeah.
In terms of the metrics and things that are going on.
Yeah, and I mean, it just shows you you know, again, why everyone keeps looking at the job market, because as long as Americans have jobs, they like to spend, and as long as they spend, the economy keeps chugging along, you know, for all of our challenges. That's kind of the simple calculus of it.
All right, well, let's talk a little more about just what August looked like. We thought for a while that it was kind of going to be the doldrums of August, but it looks like we're going to finish the month down on the S&P 500 by only 1.4%. Given that we were down last week by, what, negative 5.5%, that's pretty remarkable to see. In the short term, where do you see the markets going?
Well, I mean,
you laugh like you don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer, but I do think that the good news is
Bill, I don't know if you know, but you're chief investment officer at Glenview Trust. I hope your bosses aren't listening, because this is your job.
Quick, Bill, make something up.
I forgot my magic coin that I flipped. So,
but this is what you do. You have to figure out, right?
Yeah.
For your clients. So what is investable? What's actionable?
Well, I mean, I do think earnings have probably bottomed. So, you know, I think that is a positive for the stock side of the equation. You know, I'd probably lean a little bit more towards some of the less cyclical things, some of the more staple-ish kind of stuff that's been, hasn't done nearly as well, you know, because you've got the AI stuff that's just been on fire.
Do you know how many times we're going to talk AI, I feel like, today in terms of the conversation?
I mean, even the sponsors are getting into AI here.
Yeah.
USTA is getting into AI.
I mean, it really has dominated the returns, obviously, you know that.
But is there?
I think in the long run there is. I just sit there and worry that, you know, you, just like we saw, because I've been around long enough to been for the tech bubble, there was a there, right? Clearly, the internet was a big deal.
But it wasn't pets.com.
Yeah, you're right. And so you do have to separate them out. But also, things get overdone a lot of times.
Is NVIDIA overdone?
I will say we luckily owned it this year to start the year. We've owned it for quite a while, actually, so we're very happy. But we've trimmed it a bit because it's just tough.
But you haven't sold out of it.
No, we haven't. I think part of the issue is you can make a good case if it can continue to grow anywhere near that pace. Obviously, it's not expensive. But that's a hard call. I mean, I've listened to all the experts on it, and, you know, I think I like holding some.
Well, and they've actually been the numbers. Oh. They are showing up in terms of their growth numbers, right, and their outlooks.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of the one firm, I think, that you can say has actually made money from AI so far. I mean, everyone else kind of talks about it, but there's not actually necessarily cash in the till from it yet. I think it'll come.
Tim and I often say, you've got some new client comes to you, institutional or a wealthy client, and said, you know, here's we've got some money we want to put to work. How do you do it in this environment, especially in an environment where you look at treasuries and I can put it there, make a decent yield, and with not much risk? But what would you suggest? And I realize long term, right, I get it, but what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, we own a lot of T-bills at the moment, you know, and mixed with stocks. So we kind of
2, 3, 5 long term or shorter end.
The
bills.
Yeah, bills, a lot of bills.
Okay.
Because part of it is we think about it, we say, well, we generally have a good slug of stocks, so we think of those as, you know, long duration assets. We get paid, you know, we're okay holding some short duration assets on the other side. Plus, you know, you heard my kind of view that maybe inflation's a little stickier than they think it's going to be, so that's also tilted us towards staying toward the lower end of the duration, which has worked out really well. I mean, it in terms of, you know, relative.
What about cash right now? Are you guys have a good portion, and do clients have a good portion in money market funds? You can get over 5% there too.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the same thing. You know, T-bills, cash, that's interchangeable essentially. Yeah, I mean,
what percentage do you think is a typical account with you in terms of cash? I mean, is there? I guess my question is there still a lot on the sidelines?
Yeah.
I mean, I'd say at our firm, there's generally a lot on the sidelines, but that's the normal for us because we're all ultra high net worth, net worth primarily.
Okay.
So, we generally have a lot of cash.
Bill Stout, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here.
Okay, go watch some more tennis.
Yeah. Chief Investment Officer, just reminding you.
And great job with the weather, by the way.
Oh, thank you. We did that. Yeah.
We did, you know. Glenview Trust Company, of course. Folks, we just have about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. S&P 500, just call it unchanged. The Dow just down about 110. The NASDAQ, a gain of about 60 points. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser along with Tim Stenovic, live at the U.S. Open. This is Bloomberg. You okay over there, buddy?
Getting there.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast,
available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern
on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app.
You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.